Welcome to session 154. Did Joseph Smith know himself? Do we know ourselves? We join the presenter, Eugene Kovalenko, with his remarks already in progress because the recording for this session started late.
Would we still be here if Joseph had actually known, acknowledged, and understood his shadow? The shadow is a term introduced by the great Swiss psychiatrist and Christian mystic Carl Gustav Jung in the 20th century. It describes a dimension of ourselves that we Mormons and we Christians, to say nothing of the rest of humanity, seldom consider or else deny and ignore. Of course, we know what the consequences of ignoring something are by recalling Joseph's famous boast, "No man can be saved in ignorance," or "A man is saved no faster than he gains knowledge." Focusing on this statement, one might legitimately ask, "Saved from what?" And gaining knowledge of what? Consider knowledge of the shadow. This is that unconscious aspect of every human being consisting of repressed weaknesses, shortcomings, and instincts. It can also be the source of creativity. If Joseph had known and understood his shadow, which of course in those days he had no tools for doing so, do you suppose he would have disclosed it? Probably not. Just as most of us here today would probably be reluctant to disclose ours, let alone acknowledge and understand it. I suppose Joseph, in examining and his boasting behavior, would likely have dismissed his shadow, as perhaps many of you would, as being diabolical and unworthy of dialogue. I cannot answer this question for any of you, but I am confident enough these days to answer it for myself. One of my sons suggests that even if Joseph had been aware of that aspect of himself, he could not have disclosed it. Otherwise, the community back then would not have survived, since at that early level or altitude of consciousness or development, the fledgling community needed a superior mythic icon to rally around. I agree with this. What is the implication of the above rephrased question? Would we still be here if Joseph had actually understood his shadow? I dare say that we are all here today not because of Joseph's self-knowledge, but because of his self-ignorance. His public and private behavior was guided by something well beyond his conscious awareness, which he believed was divine, and dare I say, not unlike the attitudes of the Russian Tsars or even Mohammed. He trusted his divine revelations completely, without question, and required others to trust them in the same way. Could it be that Joseph felt what Joseph felt was divine came from his shadow, which at best was a mixed bag? My confidence in this assertion comes from having learned much about my own shadow over the past 40-plus years. This has freed me from feeling bound by Joseph's private story, that is, feeling bound by his own ego interpretations of his revelations, and being free to see the collective shadow projected on the world at large by the ecclesiastical enterprise he founded. Perhaps the most obvious historical example of this institutional projection was the LDS Church projection of its collective shadow, or darkness, on the Negro race. Individual and collective shadows are most dense when ignored and capable of serious unconscious mischief, but they can also become wondrously creative when brought into the light of awareness. In this paper, I will offer a perspective of the Joseph Smith that has gradually become known to me over a period of almost 7 decades. Then I will discuss what I mean by self-knowing beyond the life and teachings of Joseph. In this regard, I will talk in specific terms not only about Joseph's shadow, but about our individual and collective shadows as well. I will then invite you to reflect on your perspectives of how Joseph lives within your own psyches and how he has affected you personally, including his shadow. That is, if you are aware of it. I will ask how well you truly know him, how well you truly know yourself, and how well, if at all, you know your own shadow. Furthermore, if you have a strong reaction while hearing this paper, I appeal to you to accept and acknowledge your feelings without judging them or me, and then step aside and witness how they develop with compassion from a deeper place within yourself. You might be surprised to learn something new about yourself apart from what you believe about Joseph. Antecedents to this paper. This paper has several antecedents. The first is an article entitled An Old Mormon Writes to Harold Bloom by Henry Miles, published in Dialogue. Before reading Miles' article, I had previously, admittedly with prejudice, ignored Bloom as someone who had allowed himself to be seduced by Joseph and who was given to hyperbole about Joseph's place in American history. The Miles and Bloom correspondence published in Dialogue dissolved this prejudice and gave me new respect for both men. I telephoned Henry at once to discuss his article, after which he sent me Bloom's 1992 paper in the Yale Review called The Religion-Making Imagination of Joseph Smith. It was only after receiving this Yale paper that I discovered Bloom's essay in Sunstone and wrote to invite him to discuss the final question, which was the last line of his essay. This is 2007. When Bloom promptly replied, "Dear sir, I am too unwell to answer," I resolved to discuss this question at this symposium. Harold Bloom's perspective is Joseph Smith. Yale professor Harold Bloom, celebrated author of The American Religion and ardent advocate of Joseph Smith's primary place in American history, asks a critical question at the end of his provocative Sunstone essay on perspectivism and Joseph Smith. In echoing Fawn Brody's classic biography, No Man Knows My History, Bloom confesses, "I believe Joseph when he says we don't know him. To me, it is the most important statement of his life." Bloom then ends his essay with the title question, "Did he know himself?" Since the good professor is not now available to us, I propose to discuss his question with an emphasis on how the rising generation might respond to it. How do our youth answer such a question, not only about Brother Joseph, but about themselves? For that matter, how do the rest of us answer this for ourselves? The perspective of the rising generation. In reflecting on these questions as a focus for the rising generation, I came upon this thoughtful challenge in the recent issue of Cosmos magazine. Quote, "Imagine that our grandchildren could live in a world where the full blossoming of their individual and collective talents and creativity is at the center of society's attention." Unquote. This caused me to reflect anew on my own children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. After reading Bloom's several papers about Joseph Smith, plus his book, The American Religion, I imagined that Bloom's short answer to his own question, "Did he know himself?" would be a simple no, but with a complicated, ironic smile. In view of the above statement in Cosmos magazine, can anyone in this Sunstone audience seriously claim that the center of attention in our present Mormon society is, as I believe it should be, the full blossoming of our grandchildren's individual and collective talents and creativity? Some may ask, which part of our present Mormon society do you refer to? By Mormon society, I include much more than the Salt Lake City LDS establishment. No one in this audience will be surprised to learn that there is an ongoing and accelerating proliferation of Mormon birth groups that cover a broad spectrum of belief and practice. All one has to do is Google the word Mormon on the internet. So we need to be careful how we define our terms. Sunstone casts a broad net over this proliferation by inviting anyone with Mormon roots or interests to participate. This includes not only the Salt Lake LDS, but the Community of Christ, RLDS, Fundamentalist LDS, the FLDS, and all other LDS splinter groups, including ex-Mormons, post-Mormons, Reformed Mormons, retired Mormons, and so forth. I suspect that Bloom would include all these groups in his term, the people, to which he attributes to Joseph Smith's religion-making genius. To be more precise, let us assume that Bloom's term a people can better be called the people of the book, as Clifton Jolly declared in his 2006 Salt Lake Symposium presentation. The particular book all these groups have in common is, of course, the Book of Mormon, not to be confused with other people of the book who rally around the Bible or Koran or the Bhagavad Gita and so forth. Whatever one thinks of the Book of Mormon, and regardless of its origin, the fact remains that tens, if not hundreds, of millions of people have been affected by it over the past 178 years, a book which Joseph Smith is credited with producing. It is the book of record in this essay. Whether it is actual history, epic myth, a figment of Joseph's fertile imagination, a channeling of otherworldly influences, or some other mysterious process. This paper will not address any of these options. It will only acknowledge that the book has influenced millions of people for nearly two centuries as having a familiar spirit. At the very least, it contains stories, situations, principles, and characters that give food for thought and evoke discussion. That is not to ignore other thought food and words of wisdom offered by the Bible, Kabbalah, Koran, Bhagavad Gita, I Ching, Upanishads, and any other sacred societal writings or records. The creative blossoming of our grandchildren, unfortunately, seems never to have been the conscious central concern of Joseph. This is not difficult to illustrate. In his 2007 biography of Joseph Smith, historian Richard Bushman observed that Joseph's thought, quote, is not easily encapsulated or analyzed. His teachings came primarily through his revelations, which, like other forms of scripture, are epigrammatic and oracular. He never presented his ideas systematically in clear, logical order. They came in flashes and bursts, unquote. By looking at Joseph's early years compared to his latest years, his life's preoccupation was the setting up of a self-sustaining ecclesiastical system, not the creative flowering of his or the system's progeny. According to Mormon historian D. Michael Quinn, quote, Joseph Smith wasn't particularly concerned about the creative blossoming of our grandchildren because he thought he would live to at least 85 years of age, 1891, when he repeatedly said that Jesus would return in glory and inaugurate the millennium, unquote. Thus, how could we expect Joseph to have taught such a central concern to his followers? We can't. He left no such instructions. Follow the brethren is all that remains of Joseph's main concern. Notwithstanding, it carries an implied secondary message that such a commitment would necessarily produce knowledgeable, and I would infer creative, progeny. The secondary concern, promises made to the fathers. Allow me to point out that this so-called secondary message, which is relevant to the central theme of this symposium, came at the very beginning of Joseph's prophetic career, when the angel Moroni visited him as an 18-year-old and, among others, quoted the last verse in the Old Testament, Malachi 4:6, but with a new twist. Quote, and he shall plant in the hearts of the children the promises made to the fathers, and the hearts of the children shall turn to their fathers. If it were not so, the whole earth would be utterly wasted at his coming. Unquote. But young Joseph, as well as 38-year-old Joseph at his untimely death, did not seem to appreciate the implications of this new twist. So what specifically are these so-called promises made to the fathers? In the King James Old Testament version, the promises refer to reunion of fathers and children, but they are made with threatening language. And he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. In the Moroni version, such promises are planted in the heart with the non-threatening explanation, if it were not so. It occurs to me, in looking more closely at these so-called promises, that they are those of redemption from error, with the hope of experiencing love and joy, or heaven on earth, That is the promise of utopia. In Joseph's terms, it was the New Jerusalem, or Zion. This vision was surely not the personal life experience of Malachi, or any of the prophets who preceded him, with the possible exception of Enoch. These prophetic promises reflected a yearning for better times. I suspect that in practical terms, these promises can now be reflected in the lives of those creative, blossoming children who, in being encouraged to express their creativity, will eventually redeem their old, often befuddled and wayward fathers from the gods of judgment and condemnation that we, the fathers, grew up with and passed on. The children will instead teach us from their own more healthy experience of the God of love, joy, and creativity, having cultivated the seeds of hope and bringing them to full flower. Is not this full flowering of our children a goal worthy of being the central concern of the people of the book? With the psychological, spiritual, and scientific tools now available to us, we, the people of the book, are free to refocus our central concern on this creative blossoming, thereby developing the tools necessary for ourselves. We can begin by getting to know and accept ourselves and our children and our grandchildren, which is no easy task. This doesn't mean becoming narcissistic or nepotistic, which is an easy temptation. It does mean that we must refocus on our true inner selves from a more mature and higher perspective. From such a vantage point, we can become more meaningfully reacquainted with our offspring. How can we do this? First, by not only getting to know, but to accept, respect, and love all aspects of ourselves, especially those scary parts found in our individual and collective shadows. And then sharing or acknowledging and confessing our discoveries with each other without judgment. In this way, we can include and transcend troubling self-aspects by imagining creative ways of developing core qualities of compassion and wisdom. This is, of course, merely a reworded version of Jesus' time-honored second commandment, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," and by extension, love your enemies. Pray for those who despitefully use you. The best way to lose an enemy is surely not to attack, ignore, or reject him, but to make of him a friend, first internally and then externally. In the face of modern terrorism, this is obviously easier to do internally than externally. This also recalls the core Socratic principle, "Know thyself." Why? Because it is truly only through the cultivation of core qualities of spirituality within that we individually can develop the motivation and the clarity to support the creative blossoming of our grandchildren. This is what I perceive is implied in the stated independent missions of both Dialogue and Sunstone. Although I do detect in the policies of both publications what seems to me a subtle editorial fear of the establishment church. In any case, this seems in marked contrast to the mission of other offshoot Mormon institutions, as well as ex-Mormon variants who are hostile to the Salt Lake Church. These variants seem to focus not on loving God, self, and others, but on an ideology that seeks to expand control over members' lives in the name of the God of love. This unconsciously instills fear and control-based parenting rather than love and freedom-based parenting, the latter of which naturally supports and encourages the full, responsible, values-guided expression of the innate creativity within the rising generation. In this vein, and by contrast, Albert Einstein, perhaps the most celebrated figure of the 20th century, was asked by the New York State Education Department near the end of his life about what schools should emphasize. "In teaching history," he replied, and forgive the Russian accent, "there should be extensive discussion of personalities who benefited mankind through independence of character and judgment." And elsewhere, "Critical comments by students should be taken in a friendly spirit. Accumulation of material should not stifle the students' independence." A society's competitive advantage will come not from how well its schools teach the multiplication and periodic tables, but from how well they stimulate imagination and creativity. And therein lies the key to Einstein's brilliance and the lessons of his life. James Maxwell, who discovered the magnetic field equations that Einstein used to conceive his revolutionary theories, declared, "Imagination is more important than knowledge." The only thing I can legitimately bring to this discussion in support of any of these assertions and examples is my own experience. I grew up as a full-faith Mormon boy in a typical Mormon family. Then something unexpected and radically different broke into this so-called typical Mormon boy's life, which opened his eyes to new horizons. This meant facing old ways of thinking and believing, then attempting to transform and reconcile the compelling aspects of these new horizons with the old ways. This led to isolation, loss, and struggle to find the truth of his inner self. He had to deal with pain, depression, illumination, and then disillusion when approaching LDS authorities for understanding and support. His so-called seeking church, as an early unpublished dialogue manuscript pointed out, still does not understand this seeking man, but this seeking man has begun to understand himself. This outer seeking process began for me in the spring of 1961 with a group of five young men who gathered at the University of Utah. We had met to explore our faith, convictions, and sense of purpose in the aftermath of a state speech festival on the theme, "How Can We Build the Moral Strength of Our Nation?" This 1961 gathering may actually have been the impulse that in 1966 gave birth to Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. Our 1961 group discussion group consisted of the late Eugene England, Rex Mitchell, Louis Olivier, Kent, surname forgotten, and me. Gene England left our group the next year to attend Stanford University, where, with another group of four others, he co-founded Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, 5 years later. The rest is Mormon history. As everyone in this audience must be aware, Dialogue has had a major impact on our Mormon culture and society, as well as being the parent of other independent Mormon publications and associations such as Sunstone. In summer 1962, I began remembering my dreams and realized only later that I had found a wonderful tool for self-knowledge. The first dream was a nightmare, which in retrospect revealed a local LDS priesthood leadership dilemma that I did not comprehend at the time, but which many years later became crystal clear. I had just been called to serve in the presidency of the University of Utah LDS stake mission by a mission president who told me he was tired of yes men. I felt encouraged by him to be my true self. The dream was a major surprise, and I did not know what it meant or whom then to talk to about it. Not until I experienced a full-blown, near-suicidal depression less than 2 years later did I dare to look within myself for answers. Something in me was silently demanding, "Wake up or die." What was this something that threatened to kill me? Thanks to modernist insights by Carl Jung and those of more recent writers such as Eckhart Tolle and Ken Wilber and others, I have discovered that this fearful inner voice was not my true self, but a false one. It was my own ego. And here I use the term ego not as Freud defined it, but as Eckhart Tolle describes, the illusory self that is completely conditioned by the past and identified only with thought forms. The late noted psychologist Nevitt Sanford wrote, quote, "Most important is increased self-awareness. To try to deny bad things in oneself makes it likely that you will attribute that trait to others whom you will then see as being immoral, dangerous, and worthy of being eliminated," unquote. The late John W. Gardner, founder of Common Cause, wrote, quote, "Human beings have always employed an enormous variety of clever devices for running away from themselves, and the modern world is particularly rich in such stratagems. We can keep ourselves so busy, fill our lives with so many diversions, stuff our heads with so much knowledge, involve ourselves with so many people, and cover so much ground that we never have time to probe the fearful and wonderful world within. More often than not, we don't want to know ourselves. We don't want to depend on ourselves and don't want to live with ourselves. By middle life, most of us are accomplished fugitives from ourselves." Unquote. This ego thing for me was a role I was trained to accept from birth in the LDS society, a role projected on and accepted by me from the beginning and reinforced by institutional, patriarchal, and priesthood blessings, notwithstanding four or five such blessings that I remember and still believe were inspired, as well as my maternal Mormon pioneer family. These projections largely ignored and or taught me to repress the truth of my inner self, even to be ashamed of it. As I matured, I learned to confront these inaccurate projections in order to identify, change, or transform what I gradually became aware of as false. Else I, rather than my ego, would surely die. Learning how to work with dreams has taught me how to begin to identify and transform this false self. In July and August 1965, I had a major awakening in terms of a series of experiences that not only transformed my life and view of reality, but changed forever my relationships with family and Mother Church. They were experiences not unlike Joseph reported as a young boy, which met a similar fate then as mine did more recently with establishment authorities. How strange it is to me today, in thinking about the people of the book, which is allegedly founded on divine inspiration, that it has not produced leaders who know how to teach its members to value their dreams and seek the God-given wisdom hidden within them. These leaders seem fearful to teach that it is our individual divine right as literal offspring of the Supreme Being to discover and apply this inner wisdom without external approval. Not long ago, I asked a local stake president his understanding of a dream about a dream process, which I've talked about, and wanted him to, that I wanted him to consider. He replied, quote, "How do you mesh the dream analysis process with DNC 50, 13 through 31, end quote. And that was the end of it. No further discussion. Dream work and self-knowledge. There are many ways to develop self-knowledge, such as marriage, the raising of children, teaching, biofeedback, contemplation, meditation, conversation, prayer, imagination, crises, war combat, near-death experiences, hypnosis, psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, kinesiology, good reading, and so forth. In the face of all these valuable approaches, the simplest way I know of that is available to every single human being on earth is dream work, regardless of race, creed, language, education, or culture. To me, the dream is a daily miracle. Yet it is so common that we in our present-day rational, egocentric, ethnocentric LDS society largely ignore what our dreams have to teach us in our own personal metaphorical language for our own lives at the moment needed. I cannot help but think of another Old Testament quote by the angel Moroni during that first visit to the astonished 18-year-old Joseph, because of how my own family is now literally experiencing this prophecy. Quote, "I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions." Unquote. This is not a failing of Mormons only, but of humanity in general. At its present pre-Copernican level of individual consciousness, in which all of reality still is perceived to orbit around waking identity. There are several historical societies, such as cultures, whose cultures are based on dreams, such as the Senoi of Malaysia and the dream time of the Australian Aborigines. Furthermore, there are well-established, effective present-day schools, such as Stephen LeBerge's Lucidity Institute, originally in Stanford, and Joseph Dillard's Dream Yoga work. Recently, I was delighted to learn that one of my best new friends, a local Russian Orthodox priest, who for 47 years had been an Episcopal priest, has learned to apply some of these dreamwork techniques. He now reports that his dreams have evolved from the traumatic kind that once plagued him to ones of comfort, confirmation, and joy. He has transformed his inner life to one of joy, peace, and tranquility. I believe that Joseph Smith approached understanding this process, but unfortunately he did not live long enough to develop the emotional or psychological maturity to tell the difference between his personal revelatory experiences and the political ambitions of his king of the world ego. Furthermore, he believed that his revelations applied to more than just himself, many of which are canonized in the LDS and RLDS versions of the Doctrine and Covenants. To his dying day, Joseph trusted his personal revelations above those of any others, whether in the Bible, the Book of Mormon, or any other source. In the face of early skeptics about the legitimacy of his revelations, Joseph challenged them all to reproduce his revelatory experience, which usually was an effective silencer. I believe Joseph's revelations were primarily a product of his own shadow, like dreams are to the rest of us, even though Joseph had dreams. But he did not know himself well enough to understand the true nature of his revelations, which were products of both his conscious and unconscious mind. We can know a great deal about his inner life by reading his revelations. For example, when he was caught in sexual intimacies with women other than his wife Emma, the revelation about plural marriage came forth. When he needed a new house, a revelation came forth that a mansion house was to be built. And when Emma became fed up with drunkenness and chewing tobacco stains on the porch, the word of wisdom was revealed. We know that Emma accepted some revelations, but not others. She accepted the mansion house and the word of wisdom, but not plural marriage. This produced great stress in the society. The problem with the charismatic Joseph was that he insisted that his revelations must be accepted by all his followers without their being encouraged to have their own revelations. It was this alpha personality characteristic that allowed Joseph to dominate his followers and build the people of the book around his own ego. To assert this more simply, I do not believe Joseph Smith truly knew himself. This is not to say that he did not indeed have remarkable experiences and was a charismatic, imaginative, and courageous with bravado leader. But did that translate into possessing self-knowledge or wisdom? I don't think so. Because he did not know himself, he could hardly be expected to have helped or encouraged his followers to know their selves. In later years, he was possessed by his personal ego and focused on a collective, egotistic, theocratic, totalitarian agenda. Consider this final assertion. Unless one knows, accepts, and understands one's own dreams, whatever they are, one cannot know, accept, and understand one's true self to the fullest possible extent. And if one does not know one's true self, one cannot know the true self of another, to say nothing about knowing God. This may be confusing to those who equate knowing themselves with knowing their thoughts and feelings, which most people do. Most people do not have any grasp of the broader sense of self other than vague concepts of Freud's unconscious and Jung's collective unconscious, or realms of states of experience such as psychism, revelations, and such. But they have no clue as to what it means to have, much less know, a broader definition of self. I'm told by a wise friend who read the first draft of this paper and wrote, quote, "This is the core difference in frames of reference between you and many members of your audience that will make it easy for them to dismiss your important remarks as unintelligible." The presentation by Gay Lynn Henderson, which comes just after this one, will address the issue of dream work, including her own recent experiences of new ways to analyze her own dreams. To sum up my basic question of did Joseph Smith know himself, I hope I have at least stimulated you to wonder if Joseph really knew his true self in terms of a conscious, beyond ego perspective that today we take for granted. To answer my corollary question of do we know ourselves, I hope some of you are persuaded that there are many tools, especially dreamwork tools, now available to aid in new explorations of our inner selves and of each other. My appeal to the people of the Book of Mormon and any other culture is to get to know the voices of compassion and wisdom that live within each one of us. These voices exist as self-asset aspects in virtually every one of us in our dreams, if one learns how to find and hear them. These inner compassionate and wise core qualities can help each of us develop a quality of love for our inner selves above and beyond the fear of this inner knowing, which often cunningly in our waking life, with judgment and condemnation, masquerades as love. Only when we learn to acknowledge and develop confidence in this potential within ourselves can we then encourage our children and grandchildren to look within themselves rather than fearfully relying on those outside who do not know that they do not know. and know not what they do. Reflecting on this personal experience of Christ within, Paul writes, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty." Before I conclude, allow me to say one more thing. I thought I'd written the final revision to this paper a few days before leaving for the symposium, but then in a conversation with my wife, Brigitte, I mentioned just having been warned by one of my nephews who had read the paper that I'd better wear a flak jacket. So, this vest I'm taking, here's my symbolic flak jacket, for further conversation with any of you in the audience. I'm now unafraid. This vest I'm wearing, okay. Then it hit me. From the beginning of preparing this presentation, I have actually been addressing our collective Mormon shadow. That has been my audience. Whether Joseph Smith actually knew himself, this is a conclusion, he has impacted all our lives for good and or ill. If you believe Joseph has impacted your life for good, which is rich and rewarding, creative and hopeful, then I rejoice and celebrate that belief with you. On the other hand, if you believe Joseph has impacted you for ill in any way, then I suggest you take a look within yourselves and learn to make compassionate inner changes by using tools now available to us, even though they may not be understood by parents, institutional authorities, or other members of the religious family or community. It no longer matters to me whether the establishment LDS Church is built on Joseph's uncertain first vision, or that it asserts a collective proclamation on the family. Despite any of this, Joseph Smith's passion, obsession, and fanaticism created a people, as Bloom has observed. It is this aspect that was Joseph's genius, and not that he necessarily knew his true self, or that his boasting of knowing absolute truth was in fact the truth. In our rapidly proliferating Mormon community, we all have an aspect of Joseph Smith Jr. living within us. Mine is bizarre. Perhaps yours is too. In any case, I invite you to consider what Joseph means to you personally and how he manifests himself deep within you as fellow members of the people of the book who pay lip service to the rite of personal revelation about self, Joseph, Jesus, and the Most High God, or the ultimate creative source. I continue to watch with interest and amazement how members of this new generation express themselves through their God-given creativity without mindlessly copying the images and behaviors of others. In so doing, they will know themselves truly, and only then will they truly know us. My friends, let us find the courage to refocus on the above-mentioned vision, where we imagine that our grandchildren could live in a world where the full blossoming of their individual and collective talents and creativity is at the center of society's attention. Let us learn to know the potential within ourselves, reaffirming anew and looking forward to the day when, to our children and grandchildren, the divine promise of the hearts of the children shall turn to their fathers becomes a reality, and future generations will know their full flowering. Perhaps then we will join them and others in the current international wave of the future called the cultural creatives. And thank you for enduring this very long speech.
We now have about 13 minutes for question and answer period. Please come to the mic in the aisle so that your comments can be heard by all and recorded. And keep your comments to 2 minutes or under, or your questions, rather. And since I have a mic at the moment, I was going to tell you how much I appreciate what you had to say and how I have gone through this process of learning to know my shadow self and appreciating the strength that she has, the decision-making abilities, the courage that I gain from this part of myself, because this, my daughter calls that part of myself Dragon Mommy, because I can be incredibly scary. But it has helped me to realize that that is a part of me that gives me courage in difficult situations, because I can face whatever it is I need to face. And my daughter, the next generation, is being taught right off the bat that she is good with a little bit of bad, and that's just okay. Now I open the floor to the rest of you.
I refute the idea that Joseph Smith didn't know who he was. I'll read from his own teachings. I rejoice in hearing the testimony of my aged friends. You don't know me. You never knew my heart. No man knows my history. I cannot tell it. I shall never undertake it. I don't blame anyone for not believing my history. We who are old enough know that Joseph Smith was, it was taught that Joseph Smith was the head of this last dispensation on the earth. And that I want to ask you this question. On page 190 of the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, compiled by Joseph Fielding Smith, he gives the names, not the names, but the three personages who are the three gods of this earth. Everlasting covenant was made between three personages before the organization of this earth, and relates to their dispensation of things to men on the earth. These personages, according to Abraham's record, are called God the First, the Creator; God the Second, the Redeemer; God the Third, the Witness and Testator. These are all offices.
Sir, are you trying to make a sermon here?
I'm asking you, is it not true that Brigham Young taught that Adam was the creator of this earth?
Well,
listen, and that Jesus Christ was the Redeemer.
Wait a minute. Let's not get into the theology here. I'm saying these are their beliefs. If that's your belief, you are welcome to it. These are their personal, private, powerful beliefs. I am not refuting that. I am saying I have learned, because of my own experience, new ways of thinking and understanding. And I could go on, and I'm not going to do it here, but I would tell you very... Have you ever had a depression? A suicidal depression?
A what?
Have you ever almost taken your own life?
Taken my life?
Have you had a depression, sir?
Depression?
A depression. Have you been in a depression?
No.
You don't know the experience, and so I cannot explain it to you. So please, let the other person speak. Thank you.
I wish you would answer my question, who these three personages are according to your belief.
Well, I have no quarrel with the Creator and the Redeemer and the Witness. My understanding and my experience is probably very different than yours, or Joseph Smith's, or Brigham Young's, and anybody else in the audience. But it's my responsibility, and not yours, or Salt Lake's, or Joseph Smith, to make those decisions for me. That's the point.
You're not answering my question.
Well, I thought I did.
They were.
Sir, I'm sorry. Well, talk to me later. We'll talk. You obviously exercised by this. I am too. So, go ahead.
I was interested in your discussion about dreams, above all other things.
Yes.
And I would ask you sort of the question, modern psychology would tell us that our dreams are nothing more than our brain's way of collecting and organizing the stimulus and information that we see throughout the day, organizing that in a way that makes sense to us. You seem to be suggesting that dreams are something more.
Absolutely.
What evidence would you have that would lead you to make the suggestion that dreams are more than what's involved in the contents of our brains? That dreams are more than our brain's way of sort of concentrating our days.
Do you dream, young man?
I do have dreams. Yes.
Do you record them?
Sometimes.
Do you value them?
I do value them.
And do you keep a journal?
I do.
Good. If you like, we'll talk a little later about how to do that. and how to take them. I believe there's no such thing as a bad dream.
Sure.
I believe there's no such thing, even the most tiny fragment has meaning and value.
But my ultimate question...
Your point was, you were talking about Freud's attitude, it seems to me.
My question would be, what evidence do you have that dreams are anything more than reorganization?
My own experience, sir.
You know, your own experience is one thing, but, you know, no experience that you have can say something other than that your dreams are just a collection of events that have happened throughout
Young
the
man,
day. They might mean something different
to you. Please, halt, stop right now. I have my own experience, and there are people in this audience who have their experience who can talk to you about that.
Sure.
And if you're patient enough and interested enough, we can show you a method which might bring your own experience to bear that would be convincing inside.
I just have a few questions for my own
understanding. I'm glad I have this flak jacket on.
From my own understanding, from my own perspective, I would just like to know if there's any other prophets that you can compare with, just so I can understand exactly what you mean by not knowing yourself. Is there any other prophets, biblical or otherwise, or any other big theological figures that you see that you can compare with as not knowing themselves?
With Joseph Smith? Yes, Muhammad.
On which hand?
Muhammad is a man who I think did not truly know himself, but he certainly... thought he did, and he enforced his own ego and belief system on people, and we're paying for it with terrorism these days, big time.
And could you explain Jung's concept of the shadow?
Well, I can't, and I think next, if you can attend the next session by Gay Lynn, she will talk about that.
Thank you.
Are we done? Anybody else?
Oh. I appreciate your presentation. I firmly believe that Joseph did know himself, so that's my position for myself. I have three questions, real short ones. Do you believe that God selected Joseph Smith to be a prophet? Did Joseph Smith make mistakes afterward? And three, was Joseph Smith a fallen prophet?
Good question.
Because you've made some very glowing remarks about Joseph.
Yes.
And some derogatory remarks from my point of view.
Well, he's
I think those are tied up in those three questions.
Yes. I think if you refer to the verse vision, I don't believe that's the way it was at all.
No, I'm just wondering whether it's for a second or 100. Was he selected by God to be a prophet of the servant?
I think he had a role to play, yes. I don't think it's the role he conceived of himself. I think his ego took over, and that was the role we get in these scriptures so much. And I think the Doctrine and Covenants is an example of that. Those were his revelations for him. I don't believe they apply to me or anybody else. But you can accept that. He wanted everybody to accept that. And the third, what was the third question? The fallen prophet? I think he caused his own death, his own demise. You can talk about that going down in a blaze of glory, but if you really read the record carefully, there was a lot of mess going on there, and he brought a lot of stuff on. I think it was a mixed bag. Because he didn't know his shadow, he couldn't tell the difference between what was divine and what was less than divine.
I don't believe any of that, but that's...
I'm still glad I got my black jacket on.
There's some contradiction here. Joseph Smith is a good person. Joseph Smith has some shadow. And I'm wondering, the questions that seem to be asking whether or not Joseph Smith was a prophet. And the question I guess I have for you is, are you suggesting that the revelations that they printed is a mixture of the divine and material that came from his own consciousness or collective consciousness?
Yep.
Can you maybe talk about that for a second?
Well, I think it's mixed. There's some really good stuff in the DNC, but there's a lot of junk in it too. These are not words of God necessarily. There are a lot of inspired stuff. You can be inspired, you know, I'm not inspired all the time, but I do believe there. I've had the experience, but I'm not answering your question very well, it looks like.
Well, no. But is there something that wasn't that you think was divinely inspired? With him.
That
he published, or there was.
I think the Book of Mormon. I can't account for the Book of Mormon being other than some inspired work. Now, whether the process we talk about, and there's been all kinds of debate, even today in this symposium, about where this came from and why and how and so forth. But I have to say that book has impact. That's what the people of the book's all about. It's for some reason we have met with that common root, that common denominator.
What I'm getting is that some part of that, of Joseph Smith, you feel connects with the divine. And
yes.
That meaning for you.
Yes.
Is what.
Yes. But when he died, I'm just going to assert this, young sir. I believe this because of my own experience, and I'm not going to explain it right here. I don't have time. When Joseph Smith died, when he was martyred, he did not go into the light. He, in fact, discovered, my gosh, what I have been preaching is not as it is. I've got to fix it. And that, he stayed around as what we call an earthbound spirit. And he, when he came connected, that's when the mantle fell on Brigham Young, when he looked like Joseph. That's my belief. I can talk about other things like that later, which would be a little even more heretical.
Really short or not?
Does God have a shadow?
Does God? The ultimate creative source does not have a shadow. It is completely uncreated light. It's not a person of substance.
Okay, thank you so much for all of your comments, and we are finished with this session today, so thank you very much. Next one, as Eugene mentioned, does tie in with the dream analysis concept, so if you'd like to stick around for that, you're welcome to. Thank you.
Well, we're in a round of applause.